namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, our first 24 hours together. I'm feeling lots of gratitude to Marian because I'm grateful. I usually don't initiate retreats and things like that. I wait for people to make invitations. And Marian's been very instrumental in trying to create teaching situations in Tisarana, both the Upasaka group and these retreats. And I'm grateful for that. It's a joy for me to see the place thrive. And you know, Marian was our first abbess before Ajahn Kusala was here, and before I could come on a regular basis. Marian was kind enough to live here and get things going. A few other people, so hats off to you, Marian. Yeah. I think it's good to start the retreat with gratitude. We usually do it gratitude right at the end. It's kind of like the Oscars. I'd like to thank my mother, my father. The hunters are starting to sight their rifles, so it'll be hunting season soon. And so when you hear the sound of the rifle, what happens? Do you go, "Oh, poor deer, the deer are going to get shot"? Yeah, that happens. But notice how the reaction is like. If you're a liberal Western Buddhist kind of vegetarian type, your reaction to the rifle, "Oh, the poor deer." If you're a Perth-born guy that does hunting and eats meat, I say, "Yeah, that's what we do." Yeah. And who's right? Who's right? The liberal, beautiful, delicate, urban person that wouldn't hurt a mouse, or the vicious hunter out there, right? But you meet these people, they're fine. Fine. They just have a different ethic than us. So just to kind of watch the cultural reaction you have to something and see it as a cultural reaction rather than think it's absolute truth. Yeah, it's awful that you get shot, I guess. But when you're watching stream of consciousness, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, right? I try to just live in this culture in a kind of way which is harmonious, and I wouldn't kill a deer. I believe in the first precept. I think that's really, really appropriate. But I can't see my mind making judgments about others, finding a position, us and them, me and them. And that I find to be conceited, I suppose, in a certain way. So we have the first precept and we honor the first precept. But you can attach to precepts and become judgmental of others. Oh, they're going to hell. They shoot deer. We buy chicken. Anyway, that's not what I'm going to talk about, actually. So I just saw that we have a lot of deer. Saw two deer in the field, and I was reminded of Wapapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, where when Lompoa Cha, after he was finished his sort of wandering days and settling down for a monk is setting up your mosquito net for more than 4 days, I think. And he set up his mosquito net near his home village in a large forest, a massive forest. And then as he lived there, the monastery, he started to develop disciples. He started to come to him. And the whole monastery started to take shape, became more and more famous. And as it became bigger, All the trees were starting to be cut down around Wat Pa Pong as the forest was developed into rice farming. So the forest started to disappear, and they built a big wall around the monastery, a breeze block wall around the monastery. And there were about a dozen deer trapped in the monastery. Not trapped, because they wouldn't have a habitat outside the monastery. And they were breeding, and there was no place for them to really go. And we have a sentient being here. It doesn't bite. We don't bite in Canada. It's all right. Yep. Cricket. So anyway, the deer, when it was the rutting season, like around autumn, like here, the male deer started attacking the monks. So this was not that the monks were going for the female deer, but it was not good, but dangerous actually. So they decided to try to shift the deer to another monastery. And Wat Khun was a very big monastery which had about 3,000 acres of land. And so Ajahn Chah had a lot of disciples in the army. So one day the army arrived. This is Thailand. The army arrived to catch the deer, not with guns. They set up a large kind of corral run into a pickup truck. And pickup truck had a cage over. It's really rough kind of thing. So the army soldiers tried to herd the deer down this long corral into the truck. It was crazy. It was really crazy way to get the deer. But they got them into the truck, and then they shipped them off to a bigger monastery where they were safe and free and weren't beating up on the monks anymore. And then one deer was left. And sometimes you see a picture of Lompa Cha. It was a very, very tame deer. It's almost like a cow. It just used to hang around the dining hall taking feed from the bhikkhus. That's where they dealt with the deer. And Ajahn Chah really loved. He loved animals. And he loved to feed the forest chickens. He had a lot of forest chickens. And I was thinking about the difference between, say, Lompa Cha and Lompa Liam, who is the present abbot of Wat Pa Pong, the monastery I ordained in. And I've been contemplating a lot this past month or so, the difference between what I perceive as personality and character. And when I think about Lompa Cha and Lompa Liam, their personality is very, very different. Very, very different. Lompa Cha was very, very outgoing and engaging, and very much the center of the action, always looking at people, asking questions, being very jovial, or very, very silent, very still, but always very, very much the center of the whole scene. Well, Lompa Liam is much more quiet. He's happy not to say anything, and things are happening around him. And then if he's asked to talk, he'll say brilliant things, but he's much more quiet kind of person. So that's personality. And I'm just thinking about myself and my fellow monks. When I see Lompa Pasano or Lompa Suchito, they seem like pretty much the same people, personality-wise, that we were 20 years ago or whenever, 40 years ago. And yet something has obviously changed. And I would call that character. And character I equate to what we call the paramitas, the various virtuous qualities that we can develop as human beings. The boots, the shoes. Thanks, so. Maybe close that so you can get it up there. So character is something that, like right now, my upper body is quite pathetic because I haven't done that much physical work. I usually like to kind of stay strong in my upper body by cutting wood and carrying water and doing things like that. And I haven't done that, especially since that long time I spent with my mom. I, I didn't really do that much strong physical work. So now my upper body is pretty pathetic, and I can't do half a push-up. It's very sad. Oh. But the problem with that is not my physique, is that if I have an emergency where I have to lift something up or I'm falling, I don't have a reserve to do something that needs strength, right? So it'd be good if I did that. Hopefully I will. Probably won't. The barmis are like reserves. The character is like a reserve that you have. And you think about it, a person then who does physical exercise and creates strength in their body, they have a reserve. If they need to lift something or do something, they have this reserve of strength in the body. And the same with our character. A character, I think, would be those inner reserves of the heart and mind, which are called forth when there's need for them. And these we develop as paramitas, or virtuous qualities. So, Nemo Cup, hat time. Brr. So something like sitting in the hall and feeling kind of cold and uncomfortable, and you think, oh, why am I doing this? This is just religion. We're always uncomfortable in religion. We have to sit around these long talks and so on. But actually, if you're trying to be mindful, right, and you're trying to just take whatever comes as a way of developing your spiritual life, then you keep taking the challenge of difficulty and developing paramita. You keep taking the challenge like today, I have got a lot of pain in my legs for some obscure reason. And so the whole day has been one of just watching my mind being restless with the pain. It's not bad pain, it's just uncomfortable. And then trying to just stay focused on the perception of change. What does pain feel like as a changing sensation? That calms the mind. You know, that settles the mind and has a good result. And that's developing character. That's developing parami. The personality is, you know, it's not going to change over a one. And I'm not too worried about my personality, really. But character. So what changes is like the capacity to endure, the capacity to hold a perception, like the perception of change for long periods of time, the capacity to be focused with an experience for long periods of time, the determination to keep doing that, the determination to recollect the perception of change again and again and again. That builds character. And then that character is what plays itself out as you live this life, this complicated life that we live. So if I have deliberately done like retreats and meditations and so on, where I've cultivated the capacity to be with discomfort and pain in physically or emotionally, and then something happens in my life or my family or my body, I get sickness or whatever, the barami, the character, the reserve of these good qualities helps me to be at peace with the way things are. Now that in itself is profitable, isn't it? I mean, it's very, very profitable to not to blow it when things get complicated. Very, very profitable. But more than that, it's also a foundation for the deeper understanding of the Dhamma. The deeper realization that the Buddha had was that there is something which is not conditioned, not a thing. But he taught about Nibbana. He taught about the liberation from suffering. He taught that there was the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed. He taught about non-grasping of the khandhas, not attachment to the khandhas. And it's the attachment to the khandhas which keeps us preoccupied, which makes us unavailable to that realization. So it's attachment to the khandhas, preoccupation with the khandhas, keeps us distracted. We are unavailable for anything new. There's no profundity in our life because we're constantly distracted by, reacting to, enthused by, disgusted by the changing conditions of the mind-body experience. And that very constant distraction and confusion and concern with the five khandhas prevents us from realizing, seeing what the Buddha was talking about, what the Buddha realized. So the paramitas are the sense of developing character, then not only does it make you a more happy person, a more mature person, a person who responds to life in a better, in a more appropriate way, but, and I think more importantly, that becomes a foundation of non-reaction, of non-attachment. And in non-attachment, the mind begin to glimpse the possibility of the peace which lies outside of the khandhas, around the khandhas, but not a part of the khandhas. And that's glimpsed through the awareness of change. So whatever bits of your psyche or your bodily experience or your emotional experience compel your attention all the time, those bits you have to understand and learn how to let go of. So one of the things one wants to observe in one's own conditioning is when I have an encounter with life in some kind of a way, and that encounter then echoes in my mind for an hour or 2 hours later, what's going on? Why isn't the encounter just a normal encounter? Why does it linger and echo in my mind for a day or two or three or four? What is that? What is going on? Because that lingering, that re-engaging with something that happened 2, 3 days ago, 4, 5 years ago, that constant re-engaging with it is attachment to khandhas. And that in itself means a hassle, nothing fresh in it, nothing new in it, but also it's this attachment to or engagement with something which is very unprofitable, does not lead to your happiness or anyone else's happiness. And so these are the things we're trying to observe in ourselves as moods of the mind, the way the moods of the mind operate. Is my voice still carrying okay with this rain sound? Yeah? I could use the mic, but I'd rather not. If you need, I can use the mic, tell me, let me know. So like today, what preoccupied your mind? Not as a judgment, you know, not to say that, oh, thou shalt not be preoccupied. Not like that, but what is it? What is it that kept your attention? Was it the present? The sound of the rain, the wind? Like I found the wind I really enjoyed the sound of the wind today. Just the sense of like this, like a being somewhere out there just every now and then came in and came out. I kind of really quite enjoyed that. It was quite a pleasant experience. But it wasn't a preoccupation. I wasn't then thinking about wind, 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 wind afterwards. There's a very immediate experience. It has a quality of beauty. It arises, it ceases. There's no baggage left over. So I'm still engaged to the khandhas, but it's not through attachment, it's through presence. Presence of change. So ask yourself what kinds of moods preoccupied your attention today. Or maybe they didn't. Maybe your mind was just totally present, moment by moment, moment by moment. Great, good. But maybe not. Maybe you were mulling something over or feeling excited about something or creating something or whatever. And to look at that and begin to let go of it is the task of liberation, because the constant preoccupation with all that stuff bars access to the transcendent, bars access to Nibbana, to the deep peace of the mind. So then the task of the contemplative or the meditator is, okay, what kind of practices can I do to not go there? And that resolve or that determination to do that or the curiosity to do that has to come, seems to me, from understanding the project of Buddhism. It doesn't, if it comes from some kind of, you know, thou shalt always be happy, thou shalt always love, you know, and thou shalt never think about hamburgers in the evening or whatever you want, anything like that. That's just coming from some kind of a kind of a Buddha should be. I should be this chap that does this, this, and that. But that's not the project. The project isn't to become some kind of a person who never has anger, who never has fear, who's always delicate and tender in all situations, and who enjoys pain in the leg. You know, that's not the project. The project is non-grasping. I was contemplating today that very curious piece in one of the teachings about Ajahn Chah. One of his biographical notes is that he, you've probably read all this, but it's a very curious note. Lompa Cha is teaching and he's gesticulating with his hands, and he had very beautiful hands. Ajahn Chah had beautiful hands, very soft and very expressive hands. He also had beautiful feet. I think I was in love with him. Because we would wash his feet, and I could never figure out how he kept his feet so soft. Mine were always like torn up and messy. Anyway, so he gesticulated a lot with his hands when he talked. And the story goes that there was a Madhu, Madhu is a palmist. A palmist was sitting in front of Lompo Cha. And because he's a palmist, and he knew Ajahn Chah was not into the occult sect. He was not interested in that stuff, or that kind of stuff. And so the Madhu is trying to watch his hands to see the lines on his hands. And he's watching him, apparently watching, and he sees, and he says, wow. And he can't resist anymore. And he says to Lompo Cha, oh, Lompo, I know you don't believe in this stuff, but could I look at your hands? And Lompo allowed, you know, in the way Lompo did, he just kind of made fun of him and said, all right, have a look. And then the Madhu, the palmist, looks at his hands, you know the story, but looks at his hands and he can't believe it. And he says, Lompo, you've got a lot of anger. And Lompo says, yeah, but I don't use it. Now that's interesting. To me, that's really interesting. I don't know the truth of it. And I keep forgetting to ask Lompo Liam about it. But it does point to a different project than just being a nice guy that never has anger. It's the non-grasping of anger that's the practice. Now that's much easier, actually, than never being angry. If you have to never be angry, you're finished. Forget it. But if you realize that anger is just a condition that is kanda-driven, that is karmically driven, and is not you, is not a problem, don't act it out, don't hurt anyone, keep the precepts, it's not a problem, you can be at peace with anger. So what is the non-grasping of anger? And what is the not having of anger? Now that's different. So I would ask you to think about your own project and your own judgments about yourself. Do you judge yourself as being someone who should not have something? Fear, anger, greed, hatred, delusion, lust, whatever. Do you judge yourself as a person that should not be something? Then I would suggest that's wrong view. Because that's a personality view of who you should be and who you shouldn't be, and you set yourself up for suffering. That's not the project. The project is to be very mindful of speech and of action. So don't shoot the deer and don't swear at the cook. Don't kill the mosquito. Don't speak from a place of unskillfulness. Try to be compassionate in your actions. Try to be beautiful in your speech. Okay, so that's the level of sila, of action. Do good, refrain from doing harm. Practice generosity. But at the level of the mind, at the level of flow of stream of consciousness, as Lompa Sameta says, it all belongs. It all belongs. It's very liberating. So whether you feel inspired or doubtful, you like it or don't like it, it's a movement that arises because of causes and conditions, and your task is non-grasping, non-attachment. That's what you have to figure out. And non-grasping is not not having. The non-grasping of anger is not being someone who never has anger. It's simply not believing in it, seeing it as an energy, being patient with it, knowing it as Dharma, seeing its causes arise, seeing it cease. And this is Bharami, the Bharami of wisdom, the Bharami of patience, the Bharami of replacement, Metta Bhavana. Right? So why do you use Metta Bhavana? You use Metta Bhavana for non-attachment. Metta Bhavana, or the practice of loving kindness, is not to heal the world. You know, sometimes we do that. We say, may so-and-so who is sick, may they be free from suffering. That's not how it is originally designed. It's more a Christian kind of idea. Because the way those teachings were designed, they were designed for non-grasping. I don't know if when I chant for the well-being of another person, I don't know if it's effective. I do it. I love to do it. It makes me feel good. That's all I know. But the whole project of Buddhism around karma, I am the owner of my karma, I'm heir to my karma, born of my karma, whatever I shall do for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. I will be the heir. You can chant as much as you want for me, but if I blow it, I blow it. I pay the price. But if I do something good, I get the goodness of that. So very self-sufficient teaching. Very self-sufficient teaching. And so the ideas of Metta Bhavana are not the same as prayer. They're not the idea of spreading something out there, although we talk in that way, and that's a kind of a figurative way to open the heart. And it's quite helpful, but it's still very dualistic. Me and you, me and you. It's still very, very dualistic. But in stream of consciousness, you're seeing there is no self. That's just a perception that comes and goes. There is no other. That's a perception that comes and goes. And where do I get stuck? And if I get stuck in anger and resentment and so on, then forgiveness, metta bhavana, these are what liberate. These are what get me out of that terrible habit of just being caught in anger and revenge. So metta is a balancing thing. It's a liberating thing. If I thought metta bhavana was like, I like everyone or something like that, that would be wrong understanding. If I dislike someone, I just dislike them, that's okay. But if I hate them, and I hold them in my mind for hours and hours and hours and days and days and days, that's attachment to the khandhas. What do I need to do? Forgiveness. If I say to someone, you know, you should forgive that person, that's hard to do, because that's a kind of imperative, dogmatic imperative I've put on you. Me, the boss, you, the whatever. But if I see in my own mind that attachment to hatred and my reiteration of that hatred keeps me attached to the khandhas, it's not just a matter of suffering. I mean, it is suffering, but deeper than that, it's also that my mind can never be free if each time something happens, I hold it with resentment. So I see the logical choice is forgiveness. It's just logical. I come to that conclusion not through feeling guilty about my anger. I come to that conclusion from wisdom. It's the only wise thing to do, because I don't want to be attached to this stuff. I want to let go. So you get the insight into forgiveness. You have an insight into forgiveness rather than this being a kind of demand that your culture or your personality or your monk or whatever says to you, you have to forgive. That never works, right? Because it's a sort of demand. But wisdom works. When I see that, I say, yeah, forgiveness would free me there. It might be hard, but I see that's a difficulty that I'll take on. And that's character. That's building character. That's not coming from some idealized thing. It's, yeah, I need to do that. I need to forgive. Or whatever it is, the renunciation. A sense of like giving something up. Maybe I'm obsessed with electronic gadgets or clothing or food, and my mind keeps going there, going there, going there. That's not bad. You know, it's not immoral to do that, but I see that my mind's getting stuck there. Objects, things, ownership, that. And I begin to see, no, renunciation would be helpful here. And I do that from wisdom. I do that from wisdom rather than from some idealized thing that I should be renunciating. And so on and so forth. So the development of character is the should take me to the place where non-grasping becomes easier and easier. It's a reserve of strength, a reserve of all these good qualities of patience and determination and energy and wisdom and compassion, equanimity, these different qualities of character, which then allow me to be, give me these reserves to be with the changing nature of my body, mind-body experience, and not get all hung up on it. And that lays the foundation for silence, for deep silence, because now my attention is no longer taken by fascination for objects. It's taken more with the very sense of knowing. It's more interested in the very sense of knowing or in awareness itself rather than the objects of awareness. And the parami allow us to do that. A person who's very, say, like, just look at someone who's very impatient, a constant, like someone with road rage. There's a really coarse example. They get on the road and they rage. And you see how sad it is that they're not only might they kill themselves, but they're totally enslaved to someone else's driving methods. They're total victims. And they believe in it. They believe in it. That's very sad. Lack of wisdom, lack of parami. So during this retreat, contemplate that. Contemplate, like, where are your thought processes going? And why does your mind keep mulling this stuff over? And if you can, don't go there. Just don't go there if you can. And if your mind keeps going there very strongly, feel it in the body. Feel it in your body. And that's the choice of gladness in your heart. When you can be walking along the track, or in this weather, and your mind starts to grumble, let's say it's wet and it's cold and it's damp, and your mind thinks, oh, it's so cold and wet and damp, and starts to grumble, and you say to yourself, no, I'm not going there. That's happiness. You know, yeah, it feels wet, okay, it feels cold, okay, but this is the way it is now. That's happiness. Not because it's sunny and dry and beautiful, Caribbean weather, because you've chosen not to suffer. You've chosen non-grasping. You've chosen happiness. Sometimes you can't do that, but lots of times you can't. Lots of times the mind's just habitual, that's all. It's just bad habits. And to actually just say, no, I'm not going there. I think I'll be happy rather than worry. It's rather wonderful. You can do it. Just have to notice. Just have to notice. Some things you can't. Someone dies. You get a very difficult medical diagnosis. You have a very, very difficult job interview, and so on and so forth. There's some things which are take a lot of work to be mindful of. But a lot of stuff is just bad mental habits. And we can change that. We can rearrange that. We can go to something beautiful and uplifting. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection. Antamayam dhammapadaya sadhu karang dadamase.